So this morning we have Mikhail Dedeshenko telling us about quantum field theory and stable envelopes.
All right, thank you. And thanks a lot for inviting to this very exciting and stimulating meeting. So I'll be talking about the quantum field theory constructions that lead to the stuff that Andrei was talking about 2 days ago. And well, there's quite a bit of literature on this subject at this point, and on the physics side, it'll be mostly based on the paper with Nekrasov that appeared last year, and there was also a closely related work of Bulimor-Zhang that appeared on the same day. And on the math side, there's much more literature, and mostly it's Maulik Okunkov from 10 years ago, where the cohomological constructions were introduced. Aganagi Okunkov from 6 years ago for the elliptic case. And there are also some literature in between with Smirnov on. It's mostly Andrei and his collaborators who were developing this subject. Now, I'll be talking about quantum field theories in one, two, and three dimensions. So there will be 1D, or I don't know, 0 plus 1D. Well, let's just write 1D, 2D, 3D. So one dimensional, or of course we'll just refer to it as quantum mechanics on R, two dimensional on R cross S1, and three dimensional on R cross a torus, or I'll talk about it. I refer to it as an elliptic curve, and they will correspond to cohomological, k-theoretic, and elliptic cases, or they also refer to as rational, trigonometric, and elliptic. And the strategy will be to start with quantum mechanics, and then I'll spend a lot of time talking about the quantum mechanical case, and then just generalized to three dimensions directly, skipping the two-dimensional case because it can be obtained as a certain degeneration limit of the two-dimensional construct of the three-dimensional construction. So with that, let me start with supersymmetric quantum mechanics. The simplest, sort of the most trivial version of it corresponds to, so we have X, which is a Riemannian manifold. We choose the Hilbert space to be a space with differential forms on it, and if it's non-compact, we take L2 and then some proper completion in the with the norm. This, where bar denotes complex conjugation, and then if we take the and define the supercharge to be just the Durham differential, the conjugate supercharge to be the co-differential, and then of course the Hamiltonian will be just the Laplacian, and in this case you say that the space of supersymmetric ground states or supersymmetric vacua, it's just the kernel of H, which happens to coincide with the intersection of the kernel of Q and Q dagger, and of course the cohomology of Q, and Q in our case is just D, so it's just the Ramm cohomology of X. And this is just the your usual Hodge theory that you study in school, and so it's for us it's boring. Now, a more interesting case is obtained if we pick some Morse function on X. And this more interesting case, that's, of course, from Witten's work on more Syrian supersymmetry. Now, in this case, you choose the same Hilbert space, but modify the supercharge by conjugation. So it's like this, and then the dual supercharge is just the plus substitution of the gradient of F. And again, the Hamiltonian is defined as their anti-commutator. In this case, it's still true that supersymmetric vacua, which are given by the kernel of H, and they're also given by the intersection of the kernels of Q and Q dagger, and they also this vector space is isomorphic to the cohomology of Q, but because Q differs from D just by conjugation by F, it's the same thing as, again, the Durham cohomology. But what we can do now is we can scale up F. So it means that just multiply it by constant and send it to infinity. And the Hamiltonian here, among other terms, includes the potential, which is just this term. And so in this limit, you sort of localize to fixed points. Critical points. Of F, but that's like what's called the semi-classical analysis. Because then there are also what's known as instantons. And in this way, that's how you obtain the more Smale-Witten complex, where the n chains are given by the span of critical points of index n, and then it turns out that instanton corrections, they correspond to to gradient flows, so you have to solve this sort of equations. And whenever two points are connected by the gradient flow, and if the indices differ by one, they contribute, and this leads to the differential on this complex, which then also computes your Durham cohomology. So I'm not going to explain this at the moment, but this story is from a long time ago. Now, what I want to talk about now is a certain generalization of this. Namely, if anyone forgot, that the role of a Hamiltonian is to provide us time evolution on the Hilbert space. So if you have some vector psi, then we say that it evolves according to the Schrödinger equation, and so that's like the Hamiltonian provides you translations in time, said more properly, if you in general consider the bundle of Hilbert spaces over the time line, then it gives you connection. Now let us make this Morse function f time dependent. If we just use formulas like here with such superchargers and this Hamiltonian, then just making f time dependent is going to break all supersymmetry. And what I mean by that is that this supercharge was literally a conserved quantity, but now I can compute its time derivative. And notice that the supercharge explicitly involves f, so now it involves this plus, well, in quantum mechanics, you should, the time evolution of this operator would, well, the time derivative is computed like this. And you notice that it's non-zero. It means that Q as a charge, it changes with time and not conserved anymore, and the same happens for Q dagger. But there's a simple modification. Let me call it HT. Well, instead of taking the anti-commutator of Q and Q dagger, I just add additional term. And with such simple modification, now it turns out that this is zero for Q. It's still non-zero for Q dagger. So we break this supercharge, but Q with such Hamiltonian, it is still conserved, so we can try and work with it. Notice that I could also redefine my states according to, well, in the following way, just define omega as e to the f times psi. Then on such omega, I should also conjugate Q and Q dagger with e to the f. On such omega, let me define such supercharge Q as just a conjugation. So it gives you back the Rom differential, where the second supercharge, let me call it as G, it's non-trivial, and it's D star plus twice insertion of gradient F. And then the Hamiltonian in such basis is simply the anti-commutator of Q and G. So it looks like in such basis, when we do time evolution using such a Hamiltonian, it looks like it is Q exact, so it must be that the cohomology class of omega doesn't change, right? Yes?
Isn't your Hamiltonian imaginary? The additional term you added doesn't...
Yes, yeah.
So you're working in Euclidean? So...
No, it breaks singularity.
Oh, okay.
So it will be that the typical situation will be that F is time independent here, until certain moment of time, and then it changes, and then it's time independent again. But this region where it changes, it's like it breaks singularity, but it's a perfectly fine operator as long as you, well, project back on the Hilbert space. And in fact, that's what I was going to say, that since it's Q exact, it looks like the cohomology class appears time independent. However, what may happen is that something that was square integrable after evolution with such a non-unitary evolution, it might fail to be square integrable, and in that case we would like to say compute overlap of such state with something that is in the Hilbert space. Well, let me give you an example. Where this happens, suppose X is just C, and with a standard metric, flat metric, and Moore's function is 1/2 some time dependent, some function m of time times z absolute value squared, and this m will be interpreted as time dependent mass. Now, if we just have constant mass, then we can find that this solves. Let's say that mass is constant first. Then we find that this solves a Schrodinger equation, and also such two form solves. And then if mass is positive, then this one is square integrable. So this one is L2 for positive mass. And this one is L2 with respect to this norm for negative mass. Now, if m of t is some non-trivial function of time, then you can check that psi naught still solves. Schrodinger equation, whereas psi 2 does not. And then we can consider configuration where mass changes as sign over time. Again, which condition?
You wrote m prime of t equals 0 at the bottom, but
non-zero. No, yeah. So thanks. Then I can consider mass profile. So if this is time, where mass say is positive at minus infinity. Well, let's say this is mass positive at minus infinity, then changes, then becomes negative. Then at minus infinity, we can start with e to the minus f, which is a square integrable solution. And because it solves Schrodinger equation, it just tells you that it evolves and becomes e to the minus f at plus infinity, which is no longer a square integrable there. And in fact, in this case, if you try to compute overlap of this unnormalizable solution with a normalizable vacuum, it happens to be zero. So, well, clearly this such problem is not very nice. You started with a vacuum and then you just quit the Hilbert space and get another vacuum and there's no overlap. To make the problem nicer, yeah. Well, in this case, it's easy. The easiest expression would be here, because I'm just commuting this, anti-commuting this and this. So it would be Laplacian plus twice the lead derivative along the gradient of f. Psi 2 is this.
Okay, I see. Thanks.
All right, so to make the problem nicer, let me... introduce equivariants, or make things equivariant. And so what that means is that now I modify the differential instead of just writing D here, I write equivariant differential. So here is a contraction with a vector field. Let me write it as epsilon dot V. I'll explain what it is. So here, epsilon dot V is a linear combination of some parameters epsilon I and vector field VI, where parameters are equivariant parameters. And in the physics context, they are actual complex numbers, not just formal parameters. And VI are isometries. Of X, and such that they also preserve the Morse function should be invariant under them. Well, now the supercharge doesn't square to zero, it squares to the lead derivative along this vector fields. Q dagger is also slightly modified. And then there's a one form obtained from this vector field with complex conjugated parameters. But then we take the same Hamiltonian as before. And if we pass to such coordinates, or I mean to such basis, well, just do a redefinition, then this Q simply becomes the covariant differential itself without conjugation. And there is a certain G. And this formula is still preserved, still valid. Now, in this case, it is natural to study and compare critical points of the Morse function and fixed points of the vector field V. In all our applications, F will be such that they either coincide or the fixed points of the vector field V are a subset of the critical locus of F. Now, there will be an exercise, which I guess I'll provide more details on it during the problem session, where again, so it's we'll consider x equal to c, with the same Morse function, but now we'll also consider u1 that's acting on C, and study this so that this equivariant the vector field is just the rotation of C, and then the problem will be to find the for given time independent mass m to find the normalizable L2 ground state. So we will again write it as in terms of omega. So really the question is to find this omega. And then study a bunch of properties of it, which I will give more details, ask the rest of questions during the problem session. Now, one thing that we'll find is that now there's no such pathology. This ground state is actually normalizable for both sines of M. And as we send mass to infinity, this omega will be supported either plus or minus infinity is supported on the attractor of the fixed point of this action. And by attractor, I mean the same thing as what Andrei mentioned in his lectures. So in this case, we have the gradient flow of F, and we just simply consider all the points that flow to the origin. Like for one sine of mass, it will be, for example, the whole plane in this case. For another sine of mass, it will be just the origin, because the flow goes from zero to infinity. So the only point that stays at zero is zero itself. But then there are more complicated, more interesting examples, like if one takes x to be C2. And now it's acted on by two copies of U1. So if I write it as C cross C, and then one copy of U1 acts on one C, one acts on another C. For this example, the Morse function is M and then difference of absolute values of Z1 squared of Z1 and Z2. And in fact, this example is a prototypical for theories with 8 superchargers, such as 3dn equals 4, because in this case the fixed point will still be the origin, but then the attractor will always be a Lagrangian submanifold, because notice that in this case X is a holomorphic symplectic, and for either sign of mass the attractors will be, it's either one first C or the second C, so it's always a Lagrangian, complex Lagrangian. Now, the general setting I can sort of give it to you in a form of conjecture, and then we'll provide a path integral evidence, as is so let X be, for example, hyperkeller, though perhaps there's some evidence that in the most general case I can probably consider even just Keller. But, well, let me focus on hyperkeller, though. Or maybe not necessarily. Sorry. So there's a moment map, which in the hyperkeller case is not a real moment map, for some, I'll call it flavor symmetry. So it's just global symmetry GF. In physics, it's called the flavor symmetry, acting on X, and its maximal torus will be denoted by A. So let this be a moment map. For this A action on X. The Morse function will be some time-dependent mass, which is either one mass or like several masses. There are as many masses as many dimensions this torus has, and I can I should say that mass then belongs to the Lie algebra of this A, and I can contract it with a moment map, and I take this to be the Morse function. And then I define another torus, which is A times, in the hyperkeller case, there will be one more additional symmetry, which is, I will describe it in more details later, but it will be denoted U1 H bar, which scales the holomorphic symplectic form with weight either 2 or 1, depending on conventions. So in this case, if M is generic, and for a certain class, of X, the T fixed points coincide with the critical locus of F. And we will be studying the equivariant cohomology of X equivariant with respect to this torus. So let me draw the following picture. So let's imagine that this is a piece of X, and there are certain fixed points. They are okay. They are connected by there are some gradient flows. They also coincide with a orbit for complexified. If you act with complexified torus, well, that's because we chose such a very special Morse function. Then, if you choose focus on some critical points like this, then there's this. Its immediate attractor, let's call the critical point P, then this thing is attractor of critical point P, and then if we also include all attractors that connected are sitting above it, this will be called the full attractor. And the corresponding points, like this, for example, to call it P prime, they will be identified as by partial order by saying that they're great, larger than P. Then, if we look at a ground state associated to this critical point P, and there's something I didn't explain to you in this case. Like, remember at the very beginning, I told you that you get the Morse-Mayer-Witten complex, which computes you the ground states or the cohomology, and then there are corrections due to instantons. In this case, for such spaces and for such Morse function, there are no corrections, so critical points are in one-to-one correspondence with isolated supersymmetric vacua. Then, so I can consider ground state, supersymmetric ground state associated to point P. As usual, as we did before, go to this alternative description, which differs by a factor of e to the f. This chalk is really fragile. Then, as we sent mass to infinity, this omega behaves, it just becomes supported on this full attractor. And as a class in the equivariant cohomology, it becomes roughly the sum of delta forms supported on the attractors. Let me write it like this, of critical points that sit above P or P itself. So it's some more refined property of ground states, because if you just look at psi, then because of this e to the f factor, you will find that psi is just localized around the critical point P. But if you strip off this e to the minus f factor, you find that the omega, it is in fact localized on this attractor. So formulated in this form, in this way, as a property of an exact supersymmetric ground state, let me call it a conjecture. But of course, certain parts of it can be done exactly by localization. Oh, and yeah. So in physics, the vacuum wave function can be understood as something that is computed by path integral on the half line, where, well, let me now, from now on, work in Euclidean time. So you do a weak rotation, and now y will be my time variable, and it will be real. And then as you compute path integral in Euclidean time, as it's usually referred to, at y equals minus infinity, I choose some asymptotic boundary conditions that correspond to the P vacuum. Well, basically it means that the variables tend to this critical point P. Then here, as an output of a path integral, you get this ground state as a wave function, as a function of boundary conditions imposed here. And this computation is done with a Lagrangian, which is a, well, let me write it actually. There's a kinetic term. Dot denotes time derivative. There's a potential. Well, I'm actually writing action for non-equivariance case, but one can then introduce the equivariant deformation as well. And so here, I'm just curious, out of the mathematical audience, how many people are like comfortable with expressions like this? Roughly half. So here, x as a function of time, it's just. Just a map from R, or in this case, from a half line, to our target x, and there are also fermions. Well, if you, they are sections of the pullback of the tangent bundle to X, and chi are sections of the pullback of the cotangent bundle of X, and then this supercharges, they act in the following in a certain way on these fields, such that the Lagrangian is invariant.
I have no idea what happened on that board. What was the point of this discussion?
Well, first of all, the discussion is not over yet, but the point was is that I'm trying, in the process of providing certain argument for this property. So I just wrote you the standard Lagrangian for supersymmetric quantum mechanics and said that when you consider it on the half line, it produces you the ground state at the boundary.
Okay.
And the ground state in the form of this psi. Now, if and I didn't write how the super how this Q acts on the fields, but if I did, one could check that this Lagrangian, there's a Q exact piece. So, technically, I should write it as an anti-commutator with something. And there's a total derivative of our Morse function with respect to time. And such total derivative is often referred to as a topological term. Because it doesn't involve metric. Now, the if I want to compute omega, not psi, right? So it differs by this. So this is really something known. Such conjugation is like known as often called canonical transformation, and this omega is computed by the same configuration. Here I have vacuum P. Here I find the this vacuum omega p. But I should drop the topological term in the Lagrangian. So I just take the q exact Lagrangian. Which slightly differs from this one, because it's named by this topological term. And now the kinetic term and the potential are combined together. Into the following expression. Plus the fermions this part is not, the fermionic part is not unchanged. So when I say that omega is computed by this, it's usually written as in the following way, that the path integral over all these fields, and let's imagine that we've defined it in some way with boundary conditions that the field x mu, let me call this such x, field x mu at zero is x. Maybe use another variable here, theta. It's a Grassmann variable. And I say that psi mu at zero is theta mu, and x, as I go to infinity, tends to p, whatever is the pth fixed point. Now, in this formulation, if I now send mass to infinity, sending mass to infinity is like sending the Morse function to infinity. Well, because we have this Morse function. And because of this term, it's clear that everything localizes to such inverse gradient flows. So the contributions to the path integral come mostly from the neighborhood of such solutions of such equations. And that provides rough intuitive explanation why you find that this omega becomes localized on the attractors, because those are the points that under this inverse gradient flow land at the vacuum P. So we can interpret this as a map where we take the equivariant cohomology class that is Poincaré dual to the fixed point P. And it's something, for example, we can think of it as a class in the equivariant cohomology of this point. And instead, we get this class in the, it goes to omega P at infinite mass, which is interpreted as a class in the equivariant cohomology of X. Now, the claim that this is up to possibly normalization is the cohomological case of stable envelope. Or more generally, we don't have to work with generic masses, or it can happen that the critical locus of the Morse function is not just the set of isolated points. So, but we can still run the same construction where we send mass to infinity. And so more generally, we get a map from the equivariant cohomology of some fixed locus to the equivariant cohomology of the entire X, where A is a torus Well, the torus of masses. But the torus whose generators correspond to this massive.
Can I ask a question about the differential form degrees? So it's like these states, I'm supposed to think they're elements of this Hilbert space, which are like differential forms. And the vacuum at minus infinity is a distributional top form, like you're taking a delta function at the fixed point, right? But then you're saying like under this whatever sort of flow in high mass limit, you get these delta functions supporting on the attracting set, which I guess are like middle forms, like those things are always Lagrangian.
Yes.
Is it kind of clear somehow that that should be happening from this like sort of physical description? Like how should
So first of all, physically the form degree corresponds to the fermion number, so it's like how many psi's you have in your wave function. If I didn't turn on equivariant parameters, then the fermion number would be conserved, and what was a p-form would stay a p-form forever. With equivariant parameter, it is not conserved, so it's like you have... Equivariant form is a linear combination of forms of different degrees, and for that reason, like, it doesn't really contradict to anything that you start with delta form there, you end up with such delta form, and the reason is really that you get these gradient flows as a follows from such a heuristic path integral description. Okay.
Thanks.
Sorry, can I ask a question?
Yep.
Wasn't the critical points of F are the fixed point locus of T? But then you just map from the fixed point locus of A to...
Right, so... these two as vector spaces, they're of course the same vector, like the same dimension, the same dimensional vector spaces. But the map is a non-trivial map. So you can here the classes you can write them in terms of the fixed point classes.
And what I think my question is more elementary. So P, the point that we are, which is the vacuum point, isn't it the critical point of F?
Yes.
So it actually is a fixed point of T?
Yes.
Then why do we map from the fixed point locus of A? Like why is HTXA maps to HTX? Why isn't it HTXT mapping to HTX?
Well, what really is happening here is that we consider, so I haven't come to that yet, but we consider an interface where on the one side mass is zero, on the other side mass is sent to infinity, and where the mass is zero, you really work with a whole X. Well, on the side where the mass goes to infinity, you only work with XA. And then this interface provides you a map, this map. But yeah, that's probably not the explanation you're looking for. No, XA is just a collection of points, and then HT of XA is just the like a collection of HT of points, like as many times as you as many points you have. That's right. Well, you can consider. Well, of course, this is included in HDX.
I think the question is about whether P needs to be fixed under U1 H bar or not. You know, this u1 h bar you have?
Right.
Like, is it required that p is fixed under u1 h bar as well, or just...
Yes, yes. It is also fixed by u1 h bar. Yes. Yes. Oh, so that was the question. Okay. Okay. Now, this map that we've introduced, the stable envelope, actually depends on how exactly we send mass to infinity. So, what I mean by that is that the space of these masses, well, sometimes I refer to them as real masses because they're also complex masses. So far, all these masses were real masses. So the space of real masses is this, the algebra that of the torus A. And there is, in fact, there are some walls in the, in this space. There's a hyperplane arrangement. And so walls in A are locations where the critical locus of F becomes larger, just becomes larger, or in case, let me say that it's larger than the fixed locus of our moment map. It's a locations where such masses where the critical locus of our F is larger than the fixed locus of mu r f. So or more precisely would be to say that larger than at generic masses. So, in good cases, for generic masses, the critical locus is just a collection of points. But then, if we make masses non-generic, critical locus becomes larger. So, some points become reconnected precisely by such things. Like the usual thing that happens is that two critical points that were isolated then become connected by a CP1 inside of X. So such special values of masses, they form walls in this the algebra. More precisely, if alpha is a weight, some weight for the torus action on the normal bundle to the fixed locus. Let me denote it like this, inside of the tangent bundle. Then these walls are the root hyperplanes, which are like such values of masses that alpha dot m is zero, right? So as a result, this A is broken into chambers, or divided into chambers, so the picture that you can imagine something like this. So it turns out, so dependence on this mass is really piecewise constant, well, at least for large enough mass. And when I say that I send mass to infinity, I should specify within which chamber. So I will write it like this, infinity with a lower index C, meaning that I pick some chamber C here and then send mass to infinity within this chamber. So what depends on the chamber is not the shape of gradient flows, but rather in what direction they go. For example, you can imagine that you have three critical points, and in one chamber you will have gradient flows going like this, say in chamber C1, and in another chamber they will be going, for example, like this. I just changed the direction of one of them. So the shape of these, the shape of attractors, they are independent of the chamber, but it's just the direction in which I flow depends on the chamber. And so what is the sequence of attractors I attach to each point depends on the chamber. Okay, so earlier I described some exercises where you can observe this structure, how you get delta forms localized on the attractors in the very simple case where you have just a free, what's known as a free theory. So in physics, we usually refer to theory as free if the path integral only involves Gaussian integrals. If you wish, a question with three stars, because I don't really know. The answer is to find another exactly solvable example where you can compute the ground state omega and actually see how you get these attractors. Example with more than one fixed point, because in all these simple examples, you don't see these transitions between different fixed points. Perhaps this simplest example would be T star of CP1, because in this case, the fixed points, there are two fixed points which are in the base, and the structure of, well, okay, there's a, attractors are just the fiber of one fixed point, or also the whole CP1 for this fixed point? But in practice, we only need to compute omega at infinite mass, and that's something that we can do by the localization techniques. And in fact, engage theories. So an interesting class of theories where we want to run this machinery are gauge theories. In theories with four superchargers, which will in three-dimensional case will be referred to as 3D n equals 2. But we are still in quantum mechanics so far. You have a gauge group G, so just some compact Lie group, which is some product of Abelian factors and some number of simple factors. Then we have R, it's some complex representation. There's a superpotential, which is a homomorphic function, which is also invariant under G. And the space, what was called X before, in this case, it's just the critical locus of W. And then you take Keller quotient by G, but we will actually be more interested in the case that in 3D would correspond to 3D n equals 4, but again, we're still in quantum mechanics so far, which is, let me call it just like this, R. Then you can take R is a T star of R. Well, R is some complex representation. More generally, R could be some quaternionic representation of gauge group G. And X, in this case, X, it becomes the hyperkeller quotient, right, of this R. So in addition to real moment map, there is also some complex moment map, which corresponds in the 3D, in the n equals 2 description, corresponds to the superpotential W. Now, is this generalization in the language of quantum mechanics? Simply corresponds to making some of the equivariant parameters dynamical. So before we had equivariant parameters, which in general generate some group action on whatever X we had. Here, we just pick some group, which is a subgroup of symmetries of target. In this case, the symmetries are adjust to USP. Whatever, let me write it like this, acting on this space. We pick the subgroup. GP is Lie algebra. Let me call let me call it little phi. Point of the complexified Lie algebra. Then I define the following differential as a del bar plus trace of and then substitution of trace really means some killing form on the Lie algebra. Yeah. Then let me choose as a Hilbert space of the gauge theory will be whatever your target had. Let me call this X, not meaning ungauged. So I take differential forms on X naught. Then I also add zero P forms on complexified the algebra, take gene variant part of it. Well, and then if something is not, I'll add this L2, meaning that I'm looking at the square integrable part, and then some appropriate completion. And as a supercharge, I choose. So I take everything we had before. The RAM on X naught plus DF, where F is a Morse function, which now, of course, is supposed to be invariant under the gauge group. Then there are equivariant parameters for some global symmetries, equivariant parameters which were promoted to dynamical parameters by gauging. Let me call them the corresponding vector fields V tilde. Plus this plus, in case there is also superpotential, I should also add D of in some conventions will be the imaginary part of the superpotential. Then there's Q dagger, let me skip that, can be computed. And again, we could take the Hamiltonian to be just like before, Q dagger. Minus this correction if the Morse function is time dependent. So that's sorry, this is not X naught for us. For us, X naught is slightly bigger. For us, it's not is T star R, and then there is a factor of GC, and then there's another factor of G. So what lives here is usually referred to as a complex scalar in the vector multiplet. I'll call it capital phi. And what lives here is a real scalar. In the vector multiplet, I'll call it sigma. And then the Morse function for us can be written as follows. If I let me introduce some notations first, actually. So variables in R will be called Q. So, well, they're really holomorphic coordinates in R. Now, something in the coordinates along the fiber, so U tilde. And these fields Q, Q tilde, and capital Phi, they happen to be chiral multiplets in the language of theories with four superchargers. And I'll introduce a unified notation for holomorphic coordinates Q, Q tilde, and Phi. Let me call that U. Then the Morse function can be written as schematically like U bar sigma plus mass with dependence on time or whatever, no, Euclidean time Y U minus zeta R sigma. Now this zeta R is called real Liopoulos parameter. Or for short, just FI parameter. And it's just a central character. On the gauge layout, so the Lie algebra of the gauge group. Now you can, this F can be rewritten as, of course, there's a one term which is just mass contracted with a real moment map for global symmetries. So, and I should tell you that these global symmetries or flavor symmetries that I called, as I called them before, is just the quotient of USP that acting on your space before gauging, that I call the T star R, by the normalizer of the gauge group, because gauge group is a, by a representation, it is realized as a subgroup in the USP. So the Morse function has this piece plus the same, but for the gauge group, the contraction of this sigma, which is a real scalar with a moment map of the gauge symmetry, real moment map of the gauge. And let me call it mu tilde because usually, mu tilde, it has two pieces. There's a piece that comes from this scalar, complex scalar, which is like really in the adjoint. So this piece is phi bar commutator, Well, in the physics conventions, you would usually write some gauge, whatever, coupling constant here. And, normalizer of G in USP. Well, I said that in words, that G, by the representation, it is realized as a sub, it is mapped into a certain subgroup of USP. Well, it would be like this. Like this.
Do you want your quotient by G?
No, no, no. So this moment map, it has this part, then there's also contribution from the Q fields, which I'll just write as mu without tilde. Well, and then there's this FI parameter. So when you do hyperkel quotient, so like this part, for certain reasons it happens that it's just zero, and you only deal with this part at the moment now. And the superpotential, because I said there's a, well, now what I'm explaining you is the theory with eight supercharges, which corresponds to 3D n equals 4. But like, once we uplift to three dimensions, for these purposes, it is really convenient to describe it as a theory with four supercharges, because this is a special case of this. So the superpotential here is just like this, and it should be clear what I mean, because Q, it lives in R. Q tilde is a coordinate in the phi, but really lives in the dual representation. This one is in the adjoint, so this is a gauge invariant combination where I. Yes, it's equivalent to saying, yes, the scalar times the complex moment map. Or exactly. Then we include equivariant deformation for global symmetries. It's a for global symmetries. They include GF and also this additional U1H bar that I promised you that I would tell you what it is. So U1H bar, it is it acts only on Q, Q tilde, and phi. So Q and Q tilde have charges 1. So Q and Q tilde. So they have charge. Well, usually, okay, let me call it charge 1. And phi has charge minus 2 with respect to this U1H bar. All the rest of the fields are invariant under this symmetry. So this symmetry, from the point of view of theories with four superchargers, it's really one of the flavor symmetries. And by the way, in physics terminology, flavor symmetries are something that doesn't act on your superchargers. So global symmetry that doesn't act on your superchargers. How confusing is such a statement, by the way? Like, who finds it confusing? Okay. Well, supercharge is a certain operator that acts on the Hilbert space as I defined before, and symmetry, in the end of the day, it also generated by some operators, which are literally generators of that symmetry, and they also act in the Hilbert space. And when I say that they commute, it means that these two operators literally commute, and it's usually also referred to as this symmetry, that it preserves supercharge. So this U1H bar has the property that it is flavor symmetry, so it commutes with supercharges. If you look from the point of view of theory with four supercharges, but it does not commute with supercharges if you include all eight of them. So there, from this point of view, there are half of the supercharges that do not commute with this symmetry. And I guess I've run out of time. Actually, went slightly over time, so I'm sorry. I'll continue next time. Yeah.
Right, great. Are there any questions?
So I'm wondering in what way we're using hyperkähler other than to like just get the Morse function, or is that the kind of the point?
Yeah. So so far it hasn't been very clear, and indeed I haven't used hyperkähler in any way. And in general, the story doesn't even require to be hyperkähler. Here, it sort of makes behavior of various objects nicer in the hyperkähler case, but the general story seems like it works for Kähler case.
I was curious if you're going to, you didn't explicitly write it, but is the FI parameter also going to be dependent on Euclidean time, or is it just the real mass?
You can also make it dependent. Especially once you go to three dimensions, then a FI parameter is just a special type of mass for a special type of symmetry. So yeah, you can make it dependent, time dependent too.
Can I say a little more about what this U1 H bar means in physics?
So there's something called the R symmetry. So it's literally the global symmetry that does not commute with the supercharges, so it acts non-trivially on supercharges. So the commutators with supercharges are given by some other linear combination of supercharges. So the R symmetry, when we'll be working in three dimensions here, the R symmetry will be just U1, and here, when we'll have a theory with eight superchargers, the R symmetry SU2 cross SU2. And then you can take the maximal torus of that, will be U1 cross U1, and can take the diagonal of that. So that diagonal will be the R symmetry in this description. But then you can also take the anti-diagonal, and that's U1 H bar. So that's really part of the R symmetry of the N equals 4 theory that is global, that is flavor symmetry from the point of view of N equals 2 theory. And so we will actually turning on a covariant parameter for this U1H bar will break half of the supersymmetry and will effectively be working in the N equals 2 case setting.
Are there any other questions?
And once you pass it, and also this, the reason it's called H bar, because at the end I will explain relation to of this story to integrable systems or like things like Youngin, which are quantization of certain other algebras, and this H bar will be the quantum parameter on the integrable side. This probably doesn't make much sense now, but hopefully I'll explain tomorrow.
So, I mean, one comment which might clarify this, and you can kind of correct me if I'm wrong, I kind of think of the 3D n equals 4 as thinking of T star R as a vector space over the quaternions.
Yes.
And kind of treating all of the quaternions equally.
Exactly.
Whereas this 3D n equals 2 expression requires kind of choosing a splitting of the imaginary quaternions into a real direction and a complex direction. And
yes.
Kind of picking one of the complex structures out of your twister sphere.
Exactly, yes.
On the hyperkähler side, so somehow. Or put slightly differently, like you have that SU2 that's in the R symmetry, and the 3D n equals 1 is like choosing a maximal torus.
And, yes. Which n equals 2, yes. Mm-hmm.
Splitting into real and complex.
And so you're really choosing one complex structure and just working with it.
I actually had a question to just follow up on what you were sort of alluding to a second ago. So, like, the most famous, I guess, application of these stable envelopes is the construction of these R matrices and then, like, the Yangians from this RGT thing, this Malakukunkov construction. So is there, maybe this is, like, giving away what you're going to talk about next time, but is there some extension of this physical explanation you gave that is explaining like how you should think physically about these quantum groups?
That's the whole point of indeed this one of the applications. So far I've only introduced stable envelopes as the kind of interface where mass goes between zero and infinity, but instead you can consider interface where it goes, for example, between plus infinity or minus infinity, or more generally goes from one chamber to another chamber. And I mean, that's what Andrei introduced as this chamber R matrices, which then by applying it to the case where X is a Nakajima Kuiper variety, you can realize, for example, the Youngin acting on the equivariant cohomology of a collection of such varieties, but interfaces, such interfaces where mass changes its sign, for example. I mean, those interfaces will be the generators, and then you start colliding them, commuting them.
But some like algebra of interfaces in this quantum mechanics or.
One more question. This Hilbert space you wrote, do you really want the copy of the complex scalar in the definition of x0 and then another copy of GC?
Yeah, that's right. So this complex, imagine that you start with so if I drop these two and I just consider this, that would be like 3D n equals 1. And then if you reduce 3D n equals 1 on the two torus, you will obtain two more scalars that assemble into a complex scalar. And that's the complex scalar that you have here.
Okay.
So that's why I have multiple. So that's the complex scalar that you always have, like if you start from 3D n equals 1. Then passing to 3D n equals 2 earns you this scalar, and to 3D n equals 4 also this scalar.
All right, if there are no more questions, let's thank Mikola again.